Welcome to The Rundown. I'm your host, Justin Pugliese. This podcast is dedicated to you, the run community. Each episode, we bring you interviews with top athletes and community leaders. They'll share their stories, tips, and tricks to inspire and motivate you to keep running. Ultimately, we're all just here to have fun. From elite runners to weekend warriors, find out how people get started and why they keep going. So listen up, tell your run buddies, and don't forget to subscribe. You can find us on Apple Music, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Previously on The Rundown with Gabriella DeBue Stafford.
You can always push your body harder than your mind believes that you can. You know, like very early on, your mind's like, oh, this hurts. Like, stop. Like, you shouldn't do this. You're hurting yourself. And then you see this happen with kids all the time. They're like, oh, I'm in so much pain. This is so long. This is so hard. And then like they get to the last 200 meters and they're sprinting like crazy and they're going so fast.
On this episode of The Rundown, we had a long overdue conversation with elite road and ultra distance runner, Alistair Gardner. In his early years back in the UK, he took a liking to snowboarding and the rush you get when you rip through the mountains. Lucky for him, he was able to find that same thrill running trails where he now resides in Canada. What's fascinating about Alistair is his incredible versatility as a runner, chasing distances ranging from 5Ks to ultras and always stays competitive. Are you already subscribed to The Rundown, running with WRG, and still can't get enough? Sign up to our weekly newsletter and always stay connected. You can learn more about what's happening in the run community, hear about exclusive events, and stay up to date with the podcast. Visit iamarunner.ca and subscribe. Simple as that. You'll never miss a beat. In this week's news, the female winner of the U.S. Olympic Marathon Trials, Alifin Tuliamook, has just announced that she's 31 weeks pregnant and expecting in January 2021. She mentioned that her and her partner had planned to start a family after the 2020 Olympics, but since it was postponed and all the races were canceled, they thought now would be as good a time as any. No doubt she timed it just perfectly, because once baby Zoe is born, she'll have over 6 months to get in top form for the Olympics in Tokyo. Make sure to check the show notes for links to information about this story, as well as the ongoing protests. There will also be a list of funds and foundations that need your support, so please consider donating to help support this movement. That's all for now. Gotta run. So my next guest is as impressive on the trails as he is on the road, blistering fast. I've got to race against him at a local event, Take the Bridge, which we did back in 2019, I believe. And I didn't stand a chance. We'll get into that, I'm sure. But without further ado, I'd like to introduce Alistair Gardner to the show.
Hey, thank you, Justin. Thank you for the welcome.
Yeah, I think that's the first time we formally met. And
yes.
It was a quick introduction.
It was a start line introduction. So kind of. And then, to be fair, you say lightning fast. I think you were right behind me for that whole race.
Yeah, it was tricky, but there was a moment where I had lost the positioning and stuff, but it was quite fun the way that race sets up, where it's like an unsanctioned race. It was the first time Take the Bridge was in Montreal, and then it brought a lot of attention to the community and runners from all over. And you live outside of Montreal too, so you kind of traveled for that, which was cool, you know.
Oh, I traveled for the free beer, and then there was a race as well.
Yeah, and some prize money too, which always helps.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, that was a fun race, and it's it haunts me to this day, because I live very close to where that race takes place, so that the prim, if you remember, the first kilometer, it was like a loop.
Yeah.
And it was worth, I don't know, $200 or something if you finished first. And I just went for it. I was like, okay, let me see what I can do. I'm not going to win this thing, you know? And we were like neck and neck until these stairs. And it was these little set of stairs that climb up to where the bridge was. Almost on all of my runs, I go up these stairs and I think about it every single time.
So, the little thorn in your side.
But yeah, thank you for that day for pushing me to my absolute limit, which was great. So
yeah, well, I think we were pretty much neck and neck at the bottom of the stairs, and I maybe got like one step to the top ahead of you. And we're still only 1 kilometer into a 5K race, and I just went for it, knowing that prize money was what, like 150 meters in front of us.
Right.
And then it was just like, well, just keep on going. And then for the next, like, I was actually 4.5K, like 3.5K left over, was just like utter pain as a result. But anyway, it paid off.
Yeah, that's awesome. So how have you been? I mean, we haven't spoken in a while, but, you know, we tried to get this interview done probably earlier this year, but with COVID and everything, not possible, of course. But how have you been handling everything, and how is your kind of life, or how have you adapted life to this new pandemic?
So as 2019 sort of finished up, and we'll sort of split into a couple of things, like certainly when it comes to racing and running, 2019 didn't finish well because I went to Philadelphia to do the marathon, and I had this sort of slowly building up back pain that was just like getting really tight in my lower back and down in my psoas and things. And I ended up dropping out in Philadelphia at around about the 30K mark, having done a kind of okay first half. But it just got like went downhill from there, and so I kind of spent the whole of the winter thinking, okay, right, we're gearing up for Ottawa 2020, and then mid-February everything sort of, you know, kind of went upside down, and by March everything was shut down, and it was just like, okay, so let's push objectives back to midsummer. Okay, no, let's push objectives back to the end of the year. Okay, let's just forget objectives. And so redefined the objectives with racing. I stayed focused on staying fast and had my local friends sort of push at the track with us, and so lots of intervals and things. But it was very hard to sort of structure training around this kind of like no specific objective to work towards, because the target at the beginning of the year was moving, and at the end of the year just sort of disappeared. And as a result, we ended up sort of creating our own small goals. Like, we had a little friendly race on the day of Bromont Ultra, like mid-October, like four or five of us doing a 20K race in the trails. I did the Trans Estuary sort of like challenge when I did the whole estuary trail from Kingsbury down to Sutton. Did an Everesting challenge, did a 5K tempo, did a 10K tempo, but a bit all over the place, but at the same time sort of, yeah, just trying to hold some structure just with personal objectives in the season. It was fun not to have that constant pressure of racing all through the year, but it was a bit weird. It was definitely kind of an odd year to handle, and I think everyone sort of handled it well, but in different ways.
Mm-hmm. And so, who's building these plans? And is it you? Are you self-coached now, or is it you and your friends that decide?
So I've been self-coached for a couple of years. I've been lucky to have a couple of coaches always coming to me to sort of help me build up since my early days. And in the end, I kind of found with work and just the extreme diversity of the type of running I do, not many people try to run a 5 fast K on the road and then 2 months later an ultra trail race. A lot more people are sort of focused on specific sort of like types of races or distances. So I ended up sort of being self-coached for so many years because I kind of learned quickly and saw how to sort of best structure things. I think most of the things I came up with were either just like me jogging one day, thinking about things and saying, you know what, I'm going to see if I can do that, and checked it out and checked with friends, and then got together and proposed a few ideas. And then other things were like interval training with a 5K tempo run were just like a couple of us who had been training for 2 months said, right, let's pick this date as the objective date, and you know, just sort of set ourselves the 5K. And you know, GPS is maybe 4.9, 5.1, depending on everyone's watches, but you know, we just ran hard and sort of just ticked a box saying, you know, that's kind of what I can do. You know, if there was a real race, then that's what I guess I could do, kind of thing.
Did you do it on the track, those workouts, like the 5K?
So the 5K was on the bike path in Granby, round by the lake. So fairly flat, like a tiny little hill halfway down. The 3,000 meter was on the track, on a 250 meter track. So that was a bit on the small side for me. But I tried it again on the 400 meter track, and I kind of just matched the same time. So it was, yeah, it would be tough. 5,000 meters on the track. I'd love to give it a go one day, but it's just like concentrated pain because you haven't got any sort of scenery to distract you with.
Yeah, going around in circles. I tried it, and we I don't know, like I should know better, but my I was asking around, like I did it with a small group as well, and you know, are we going to go by the laps or are we going to go by the GPS? And on a track, it's calculated already. Like you don't follow your watch, and I did, and we all did, and we all fell short like by 100 meters. So, yeah, you're better off to count it off, like almost leave your watch and or use a stopwatch or something. But yeah, that was quite embarrassing.
Did it go all right?
What's that? Yeah, I did okay. I did okay, but I wasn't. Yeah, I didn't hit my. I hit my time, but on the 4.9 that I had done. But still, you know, the 5K. is the goal, right? So,
yeah.
But I find it interesting, like, you're talking about how you take a road goal and then, you know, a month later or something, you'll go and do an ultra goal after that. And I find it interesting. And I think for, you know, for some people, it's like you're one or the other. Like, people prefer one over the other and maybe they won't try, you know, road races or ultra races. But maybe for a more recreational runner, that's appealing because they're trying to learn, you know, what they actually do like and how they perform, right? So for yourself, like, does that become challenging when you're trying to set goals and when it's such a, like a, it's such a, there's such a variance in the distances that you're doing, you know, like from a 5K to a 50K, you know, make it more difficult to train or easier?
So it kind of helps break the season up a little bit. I think that's the best way to describe it. Like, let's say a non-quarantine COVID season. And I took a page out of David Laporte's book, which is like, I still consider him like the godfather of running. He was here in Montreal for so many years and he moved back to France a couple of years ago. He was always kind of on the start with the short distances in the beginning of the season. And as the season goes along, you build up the volume and you build up the objectives, the longer distance races and the objectives there. And so often he would sort of kickstart the season with a 5K, then a 10K, then a half, and then a marathon. And it's not always exact, but it's kind of more or less like that. And I feel that's a right way to go. So you kind of focus on speed in the off season, you focus on power in the off season. And then as you sort of get outside and the snow's melting, you can start sort of, you know, sort of building up a bit more volume. And it's a bit more agreeable to do that than rather trying to do, you know, slug a 20K workout on the treadmill, which is quite a mental challenge as well. I felt like that going back to the beginning of sort of my running career, almost like 10 years ago, I was always just focused on long distances, running long distances. And I think that's kind of an error that many people make, is focusing on that distances, because you end up kind of building up a good endurance motor, but never any speed. And so, yes, you can complete ultra races, but you may not become very competitive in them because you're never working on that sort of higher intensity. And so knowing that I've got a bit of like endurance baggage, and as age goes by, I kind of, you know, getting older and things, I like to focus on that speed work. And so I feel that I'm sort of like keeping the power when it comes to the longer distances later in the season. So let's say even Bear Mountain pops up in May time, which is the 50-mile 80K race, sort of as an early season start ultra race. I tend not to focus on that as a training objective, but because of the volume I've done anyway for the others, and, you know, I'll still bag, you know, the odd 30K sort of Sunday run, but most of my week's volume is sort of focused on the speed workouts, which are two or three times a week. I still have, you know, let's say enough training baggage to allow me to kind of perform in that race, but in just sort of allow a bit of recovery afterwards, but still keep my general training focused on that speed workout because it's so early in the season. And then as you get the summer, you know, in the mountains, and you go maybe down to the Whites or up to Quebec and run in the mountains there, you're allowed to sort of spend, you know, hours at a time out on the trails and not be freezing cold. Well, then you've got those sort of end of seasons or late summer sort of Quebec Mega Trail, Brahma Ultra, Hurricana type races, which are there later on in the year to sort of focus on as the longer distances.
Hmm. Yeah, and I was checking out your Instagram too. You race all over the place and some really beautiful scenery too that you've got to check out. So that's awesome.
Yeah, I've been lucky.
Can you take us back to the beginning, where you grew up, and were you, you know, did you run early on? Were you athletic early on? Like, because you only started running like 10 years ago, and similar to myself, like I've only been running about 10 years as well. So, but always playing sports. So I'm curious about you.
I was not sporty at high school. I was like, if there was like 12 players in the rugby team or the field hockey team in England, I tend to be like the 13th. Like I was like the substitute, the second substitute. And so like, you know, my mom would like, you know, you go and do your Wednesday night soccer training and, you know, you maybe play in the last half hour of the game on the Sunday match games and stuff and do a bit of running around. I kind of enjoyed riding my bike in the woods a little bit, but I was not sporty. You know, I enjoyed computer games and I was not like a lazy kid either. But I was never sports orientated. I was never like in the sports teams focused on training and things like that. I got to say my first like move towards being sporty was kind of a very sideways move as in, just fell in love with snowboarding and the whole, traveling around the mountains, traveling around the world, sort of visiting places, the whole freestyle aspect of snowboarding. And so that kind of self-expression side of things. And then you obviously spend hours and hours on the mountains from pretty much like first lift to last lift, and then off to the bar and enjoy the parties associated with that and things. And university was in England, and so there's maybe not any snowboarding to be done there, but it was skateboarding most days, and I'm gonna say doing the lifestyle that was skateboarding. And I was on a bit more on the rebel end. I was drinking, I was smoking, basically having a good time. University was a life lesson, not necessarily an engineering degree I was looking for. Snowboarding was always there, and I gotta say we were always active with the snowboarding. I met my wife at the time when I was in Banff for a season. This is 1999-2000, and then as a result found myself in Quebec with her. And as thanks to her, she worked at Mont Sutton as the marketing manager or the events manager. She hooked me up with a bib for X Trail Sutton, and I think this was 2010, and I do think it was, where I found myself at the start line with maybe, I've been playing a bit of soccer for a couple of years with friends, like on a Friday night, and so maybe doing a jog, like half an hour jog once a week, sort of preparation for that, but no real sort of running again or no real training. And just kind of found myself with a pair of high-tech trainers, a cotton t-shirt, my soccer shorts, and at the start line for the 21K at X Trail Sutton, and just went for it. Just ran out there and fell in love with it, and sort of things snowballed from there.
That's great, man. That's really, really, yeah, it sounds like me. I think I did a charity 10K, so not quite as long, but I went in with soccer shorts as well. I have a photo on my Facebook. Yeah. It's so funny how things change from the beginning to now, right? What was a lesson maybe that you learned that day? Like, do you remember that first race? Do you remember some of the pain that you felt?
So I do not remember any of the pain. I just kind of found myself, there was the kind of the miracle that because of age categories, I was actually third in my age category. I was probably still like in 40th or 50th or something, but just happened to be third in my age category and actually shared the podium with the actual winner of the race. And so there was kind of like a, you know, by a miracle, this kind of, nice ending to that and a lot of motivation as a result. But it was more to see kind of just, there was a moment or a couple of moments where the trails were kind of on a downhill slope. I was deep in the woods and I was kind of just flying along, not with any effort, just because the downhill was not aggressive. It was just enough to kind of like just be breezing along and just maneuvering around terrain, jumping logs, rocks, you know, roots and things. I found this kind of connection to the kind of fun that I would have if I was kind of riding in the woods, in the trees, on my snowboard, like on a powder day or something. And that just kind of like freedom and flow. And it was just a almost identical connection. And I really enjoyed that. And sort of, I had that kind of feeling. I was like, wow. And so then I signed up to the Orford one, which was like the X-Trail at the end of the year. And that was a bit more challenging. I do remember a lot more pain from that. Like, it goes way up to the top of the mountain. And so like my lungs and calves were burning trying to get up there. And there was a lot more work attached to it. But that's still the moments there in the woods, that kind of silence and that sort of connection with nature was there. And it was from that that I kind of said, oh, you know, if I trained a little bit more, I'd be find this easier and have more fun. And so, you know, I'd do a couple of runs during the week and I was still snowboarding at the weekends and things and just sort of migrated in that direction. And I got to say my passion, my connection there is those kind of moments where you're just kind of cruising, flying through the woods. And these days I do enjoy a good, like hard downhill speed running through the trails. It kind of gives the same thrill and adrenaline as when you're like flying through the woods on your snowboard.
Mm. What do you remember? What drew you to the mountains originally? Like, what was there for you?
I don't know what it was. I mean, it was actually just like my brother came home with a free snowboard video, and I think I may have like nicked it off him, and then just played it every night for like 3 months, and was like, hey. Mum, dad, I'm not going to go to university. I'm just going to go and snowboard like these guys in the videos. And they were like, I think you need to think more about your future than that. maybe do one season, see how you feel, and, you know, go ahead and get signed up for university anyway. But I just kind of loved it. There was just something about, I just didn't even know it existed, this kind of like being out in the mountain and connecting up with that kind of like flying along. And it was a cool thing. It was for me in England, nobody else was snowboarding. None of my friends, I didn't know anybody else that was doing it. And it was just this thing that I kind of fell in love with from a video. And I just knew I had to go and try it. And then eventually we did a week in the US, in the mountains, and a week in Scotland. And I tried it and I was still loving it. And I was just like, it was a magnet to me. I don't know. I couldn't be more specific, like what it was. Mm-hmm. But there was something about it, and there was no regrets. And I got to say, it was that, and then all the partying that was attached to it was so much fun. So yeah, I mean, I got to say, it's been a lot of fun all the way through.
So I have two questions. Did you get your degree in the end?
Oh yes, I didn't. So in the UK, it's like a first, and if you get a first, everyone's like, wow. And then you get a 2-1 and everyone's like, hey, you did good. And then you get a 2-2, it's like, hey, good job, you passed. And if you get a third, it's like, my god, what were you doing at university? You passed but you scraped by. I managed to get the 2-2 and my mum was like, phew, you got the 2-2, you know, I'm not gonna hang my head in shame or anything. So no, I passed. I knuckled down in the third year. I had a good time, but I knuckled down in the third year and basically got the job done. I mean, I get it done when it needs to be done.
And so with activity comes like a certain level of fitness. And I know, like you mentioned, you like to party and you were smoking and drinking and this thing, you know, which is normal for kids growing up in school. And, you know, I think we all did it, but did those things stick when you started getting more active, or did it kind of make you think like, oh, maybe if I didn't do that as much, maybe I'd be able to perform better. Maybe if I stopped smoking, then, you know, my lungs would feel better and I'd be able to run faster.
So the smoking was, like I said, the smoking was ever, I smoked like around the back of the sheds at school a little bit, with friends at the weekend sort of thing. It was never like constantly, you know, 5 a day, 10 a day kind of guy. I was never like that. But I was definitely, when it came to like going out for a few drinks on the, at university and things, you could smoke in the bars. There was just a natural connection between the two. Like smoking joints, universities, kind of, you know, learn, you know, you got that kind of like, you know, freedom, and that's the kind of lifestyle that happens there. And coming to Canada and things, and people were smoking weed there and stuff, and it was part of the snowboard lifestyle. It was to some extent just doing less and less, because, you know, you have to get up and go to work the next day and these things. And eventually there was just kind of like a drop in interest, and at the same time that drop in interest maybe have accelerated because, you know, knowing that smoking's not good for your lungs, and you know, you got to go for a run and train and things, that whole drinking aspect kind of died down. And, you know, it was still, I got to admit, there was one time before Ultimate XC, we were smoking a joint the night before the race. And it was like, oh, we'll just have a little one sort of thing. But yeah, that kind of died down, and it's once every couple of months we'll do that kind of thing these days. It's not once a week anymore. That's long gone.
For sure. And what ended up bringing you to Canada? Was it the snowboarding or?
So my wife was Quebecan, and the original game plan was to move to BC, but kind of family things stopped that, and we kind of said, okay, we'll just be in Quebec for a little while, and then we found our roots here and settled down. And so that was it. That was like 14 years ago.
And you're loving it.
Yeah, I mean, the big mountains, I've still got a pull to that. I would like to, the original plan for 2020 was to spend the summer in the Alps, like sort of finishing up with the CCC to just before heading back again. And I think because of COVID, I think I'd like to maybe spend maybe 2 months in France next summer with just sort of, you know, enjoying the mountains and being able to work remotely. All depends how the near future goes and stuff. So I'm definitely pull towards the big mountains, but it's great to be able to sort of live like right at the foot of the mountain in Bromont and train just literally round the corner up in the mountains, go and train, go to the track with my friends just round the corner and stuff. So the whole setup that I have here is perfect for training and work sort of balance.
It allows for that too. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
So after you, so I want to go back to the races, like the beginning of your running like 10 years ago. So when you said, okay, if I start training a little bit more, I'm going to start maybe seeing some better results. I'm going to feel better. I'm going to enjoy this more. Do you remember like the lessons you learned like really early on, or things that you did then that you say, like looking back, you're like, I would never do that ever again?
It's the same for everybody. Same for everybody who gets like the bug for running and training and wanting to do more. And it's sort of that overtraining aspect where you drive your body too hard and then you get injured. And so you're kind of like, oh, I'm only a little bit injured today, so I'm going to try and run. And, you know, when I warm up after a couple of Ks, it hurts less, which only is actually going to translate into training tomorrow is meaning run a couple more Ks so it warms up and hurts less. And eventually you just can't run because it hurts all the time. I think I see it happen a lot for people because we think if we don't train, then we're not learning, you know, we're not developing our bodies. I think we have to measure our training not in the next, let's say 6 weeks or 3 months of progress. It has to be measured in years to be able to become a better runner, because even a well-trained runner from a couple of years of training is likely to be better than someone who's trained an under-trained runner who's still been training for a couple of years is likely to be better than the guy at the same level who was at the same level who's just trained hard for a couple of months and not, you know, got that whole sort of that volume accumulated. Because I was really injured for a long time, just ups and downs, and, you know, trying to catch up from when I was injured and getting injured again in another way. So better management of my training, as I look back, would have been a good thing. And a little, just a bit more strength work. Two or three times a week, I take the time out to go to the gym and do proper strength work, and try, you know, avoid injury that way as well. And as a result, I get injured less and I train more and progress quicker as a result of that.
Hmm. So what does strength work for you entail? Like, because I do find strength work, I used to go to the gym more and stuff, but then I started running. And for me, it's like, when you're running like every day, you put a lot of like wear in your body, your fatigue. Mm. So how much time would you say, how much time do you put in into your strength work, you know, 3 times a week? Is it half an hour? Is it 15 minutes? Like, what do you think is like the minimum?
So it depends at the time of year, I think. If this was a normal year, normally sort of December time is a bit of a kind of relaxed period. But this year it was sort of November that was my relaxed month, and December sort of picking up a little bit more. But then let's say December, January, I could be in the gym 4 times a week for about 45 minutes doing kind of like high intensity squats or single leg squat, like piston squats with like one leg and things. So I'm kind of building up real strength and possibly even gaining a little bit of muscle mass in those 2 months. But we're talking like 2 or 3 pounds, which is going to disappear as the volume drives up. But it's kind of preparing the body to be more powerful, more explosive in the pre-season. And then as the season kicks off, and so let's say we get into sort of that March period, the snow's melting, we can run a bit more outside, there's longer races coming, that maybe drops to 2 or 3 times a week. And then by midsummer, it's probably just 2 times a week, even 1 time a week, depending if races are, you know, building up and stuff. And usually I'm in the gym for about an hour, so it's about 45 minutes of specific training. And it's legs, it's stabilizers, it's like deadlifts, squats, one-legged mm-hmm. things. I'm not trying to work on my chest bra, I'm just trying to work on on the, you know, the things that are related to being a runner.
And do you do this at home now because of COVID too?
Yes. I bought like a $300 Canadian Tire bench, which wobbles a lot, but it's better than nothing.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's good to have this set up. I think a lot of people are doing that too with the workouts and stuff. Mm. And
yep.
I know I'm trying to do more of it. It's always a good idea, not even just for running, just for, you know, like you mentioned, as we get older, that, you know, our bodies kind of break down, you know, quicker. So it's good to get that strength. I know there was this challenge, I think November Project was doing a challenge, and every day it was like, one day it was plank, one day it was push-ups, one day it was sit-ups, and I didn't do it every day of the month. But it was better than nothing, you know, and it was, you know, you get stronger and stronger every time you do it, so that's good. So where did it go from there for you? Like, what were some of your goals, and how did those goals evolve, and, you know, was it always trail, and then, you know, because you've clearly put in some time into your road racing too. And like I mentioned, I think I heard about you first at the Ottawa Marathon. It might have been a 10K that you ran that year, but and quite fast as well. But that might have been a few years ago. But how did your running career progress, and did that become like the main focus for you?
So I think I had done CCC in the Alps for the first time. I think that was 2012. And then I went and did, I'm thinking it was the same year, I went and did the Magog Marathon the first time it happened. And I was running with Sebastian Roulier, who was one of the veterans of running, and he's done things like 200, 300 Ks runs, and was an ultra running back in the day. He and I were like just neck and neck until like the last couple of Ks, and I managed to sort of sprint off and take it from him, the win on that race. And I met a guy, and he was like, hey, I think you could go really far. And I think he was maybe looking a bit too far, considering like my age and where I was and stuff. He was thinking, hey, you can even make the Olympics or something. I was like, I didn't know running. I had no idea what, like, you know, the standards of running and all these things and how quickly one could progress. But, I mean, he just was like passionate, and I felt his passion. And he was like, hey, do this training program. And I worked hard. This is sort of 2 years into running, let's say. And I worked hard over the winter on the treadmill. And I think I cut my half marathon time from something like 120 something down to 116. And that was like in a winter's worth of training. And I'm not sure those numbers are quite right, but that's what I remember. And I was like, okay, that was good progress. And then I went to Ottawa Marathon and I went hard at it. And I kind of was at the halfway mark at 1:15, but then I blew up and I think I finished at 2:37 at Ottawa. Literally like dragging my body over the finish line, and was just sort of torn between kind of my passion for trail and the focus on road running, and just the balance evolved with that. The thing I realized with road running and intervals, there's that science behind the timing that you can very much measure everything you're doing. And generally, you can measure one 10K race versus another 10K race, whereas on trail, it could be 40 minutes or 55 minutes, depending on the technical terrain or the up and down, the height of the course and things. So it's hard to sort of like, you know, measure that progress. And so that's why I kind of like get the passion of the natural side or the connection to nature and the trail, and then that kind of scientific measure of road running. And that's kind of like the both sides of my brain working almost harmoniously, and you know, one helps the other in both directions.
Do you think the training for both styles is like complementary to one another?
I think in trail running we have to kind of remember that you can run a 10k trail race and you can run a 160k trail race and you won't train the same way. And it's the same for a 5k road race or a marathon road race. So I do think it's sometimes to do with intensity and distance. And so while, you know, let's say running for an hour, which could be, let's say it turns out to be 12 Ks on the trails, like X-Trail Sutton, which was, I think, the 11.5 K qualifier for the, Canadian mountain running team, which I did. That was like 55 minutes roughly, and so you're kind of in the same ballpark time as a very fast half marathon runner or a, you know, moderate 10k runner, just, you know, in that 55 minute range. And so, you know, you're kind of breaking an hour 10 at a half marathon, or maybe, you know, 35-40 minutes in a 10k, depending on people's performances and stuff. So that's one thing versus 10, 12, 24 hours on the trail, which is completely another thing. So for me, those intensities of training are one type of training, and then those, you know, intervals, high intensity stuff, and then there's the endurance stuff, and, you know, almost just like eating as you're running, which is a whole different type of training, is a different thing. Now, there are slight variances. I think being comfortable running on trail and technical trails, you know, gnarly rocks and slippery surfaces, are a big factor for people who would not be comfortable in that kind of terrain, as much as someone who spends all their time on the trails may not have the right stride length to run effectively on the flat. So there are those variables, but at the same time, the intensities probably are very similar if we're talking about those kind of same length of time for those different types of races, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. And I'm one of the, I do love trail running. I love running in the woods and looking at the scenery, and it's distracting. But then, you know, I'm also a klutz, so I hit those rocks and I stub my toe, and that's what really is not enjoyable for me. I'm not gonna lie. But I totally agree with you. Like, the terrain for the same distances virtually can make or break. Like, I think we did the 20K at Tremblant last summer. And that was really, really, really hard. And then we did the 28 at Harricana, and that was much more enjoyable just because of how steep it was in Tremblant compared to what we were facing at Harricana, which is really, really nice.
Yeah. That's a perfect example. Like, Tremblant is technical, I think, for like almost all of that course, whereas Harricana has got a lot more flow to it, sort of like access roads, a bit of technical, but then, you know, it's a faster course. And yeah, you could probably get almost similar times despite the 8 kilometer difference in length.
Yeah, what's your preference?
I am loving right now that just like that kind of breakneck terrain. Like I say, so this year when I did Hurricane, I did the 28K and the sort of the solo, the what's it called, Loup Solitaire, like right. virtual race. Right. And that was one of my favorite races because I basically said, go hard and see what happens, because you're kind of just, you know, there was no real podium. There's no, you know, it was not a proper race kind of thing, but it was still kind of timed. And I just timed it perfectly. The last two Ks were brutal, but then you know it's the last two Ks, so you go hard. But then I went and did the Tremblant Blanc one, which was not a flagged race. That was a little bit harder because I kind of got lost a little bit just double-checking which way to turn things. But on that, you've got these sections where you kind of just got your fingers crossed that you're not going to misplace your foot on a rock or in that slightly muddy puddle is not, like, let's see, eight, you know, a foot deep or actually too shallow and too slippy and things. And so you kind of always got that little thing in the back of your head where you're like, oh my God, this is kind of going to be sketchy and it could go really wrong. And there's been many times where, you know, I've come out the woods with, you know, blood on my elbows, blood on my knees and things because it did go wrong. But again, going back to that snowboarding passion, I think that's kind of got the part of the fun for it.
Right. And so when you over that winter you made that big improvement in your half marathon, did you start to realize your potential as like a competitive runner, or did somebody come to you and say like, hey Alistair, you should really like focus on this because like this is, you have a talent for it?
I go back to the coach, the local coach, Mike, who was, he was the one kind of saying, hey, you really should, you know, you can have a good crack at the marathon. I think you should be good. You've got the endurance and, you know, the right kind of training would help you get there. But it was always that competitive DNA that I have combined with that passion for running and that connection to the freedom with the snowboarding things. So just like kind of those three or four variables all coming together that kept me going. And the over the many years, it's all of those three variables together which have kind of kept me going into my 10th year of being like a competitive runner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you are like really competitive. You're super
I try
fast.
To hide it.
You know what I mean? It's no, but it's good. It's good to have the fire, but you know, like some, you have a good way about you too. At the same time, you like to have fun and you like the competition, you thrive on it. So that's a good way to be. Like I consider myself competitive too. Like everybody, you know, when you toe the line, you want to be at your best, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. So that's good. That's how you push yourself in training too. Was there, did you start to like when you like over these years, like is there a race that you did that you didn't think you would ever do or couldn't imagine doing when you started?
I think, well, all of them, to be, when I started, all of them. I think that's one of the funny things. It's only, I gotta say, in more recent years that I actually started considering myself a runner than a snowboarder who also did some running. And that's a funny thing because I probably dropped a lot of snowboarding in order to train on the treadmill. And like where the gym is, like the treadmill window, the window where the treadmill is looks up at the ski hill on the night skiing in Bromont. And I kind of like, I'm here training, but actually my passion's up there and things. But, you know, I've got to get the training done because that's part of the training program and things. But if we go to particular races, I think UTMB does stand out just because of that is like the reference ultra trail world race of, you know, that's the number one. And so being able to get that bib and be able to do that race, I think was a huge thing. Being back in Europe by coincidence, where I used to snowboard in Chamonix and now I'm being a runner in Chamonix and that kind of weird, you know, same world, but different world kind of thing. Having my family there, following me around the course and seeing them pop up in the middle of the night in Italy when I was leaving Chamonix, you know, a couple of hours ago, that whole thing was just enormous and was great. But then I would almost equally take the bridge, which was kind of like a almost spontaneous, oh, that sounds awesome, kind of completely different you know, as you say, unsanctioned friends getting together, you know, a can of spray for a start line. That was equally fun, you know, equally challenging and things. Maybe not, it was on a targeted race, it wasn't a focused race, but that kind of thing stands out equally in my mind. And just sort of going back to that competitive thing we talked about a minute ago, I love seeing people run hard, and I love seeing other people succeed and stuff. And you know, you're always watching in awe at other people doing their thing, and that's always going to be in a race. And so you get a little bit of that no matter what the race is. And so it kind of, you know, the variety is part of the fun.
For sure, yeah, and it's that community too that we have. That's, I mean, I'm sure you know you found that with your snowboarding, but then it's also very present in the trail running world, and also now, I'm sure you've seen, like, you know, in different parts of the world, even just like how strong that community actually is. So,
yeah, I think that they're sometimes, I mean, in the snowboarding, you get up and you'd ride the park every night, and you'd see the same guys, and you'd sort of see someone just trying to get a certain trick, and they finally get it, and so everyone cheers for that person. And so there's a, you know, that kind of camaraderie right there nonstop. Whereas sometimes we get together and you just see the same guy you saw a race a month or two ago. You see him again, and obviously in the elite group, you're kind of always conscious who else might be up that start line. And it's like, oh shit, there's these guys, there's him and him and him, and oh, okay, this is going to be a tough day. This is not going to be the you know the things it was a few years ago. So there's sometimes a bit more separation. But I think when it comes to going out and having fun in the trails, it's just about having a good time, and it's, yeah, you kind of, even if you're a bit faster than the others, then you kind of, you know, you might pick up the pace, but you might turn, just, you know, you get to the trailhead, you turn around, you go back, you collect your friends, you go back as a group, you're always there at the top of the mountain, you know, having a little snack or something, and having beers together at the end, and that's almost identical to the whole snowboard scene.
Mm-hmm. Being around like that level of competition and as well, like, what are there any lessons that stand out to you? Like, was there something somebody told you that you really like held on to and applied in your training still to this day?
You've got to do your own thing. You cannot try and copy someone else, because you're not made like that person. We're each coming from a different background, a different strength. I mean, literally, we have from our DNA probably a different proportion of muscle fiber types. And so, you know, we follow other people on Strava, and we may get guidance at the end of the day. You know, the elite Olympic marathoners all train in a very similar way, but we generally have to do our own race and our own training based on where we are and what our objectives are. And so knowing that I might be towing the line with, well, I just ran with Elliot Cardin and Rémi Leroux and some other guys this week. Knowing those guys put a lot of big volume things in, I can't maybe expect to be as competitive on a long distance race with them, whereas if it was the three of us on a 5K race, I'd be like, hey, this is my territory sort of thing, but that's where I've been working recently. And so you kind of have to focus on your own objectives and not get distracted what other people are doing. And I do remember one day at Quebec Megatrail, and I think it was the 50K race a good few years back, it went out so fast, and I was just like, this does not make sense. And so I kind of just let everyone go off, and one by one I kind of picked them all off as they as they were trundling through in the last 40Ks, you know, the last 10Ks or whatever. And so, you know, if you do your own thing, it can pay off. I think that's the kind of thing you got to remember.
For sure. I'm just like finishing up the book Eat Run by Scott Jurek, and he was like he won Western States like a million times. Is there any urge to do any of those big races in North America, Badwater, Western States, anything like that?
I do. I think I'm probably a little bit more pulled to doing a few things in Europe, just to sort of mix it up. Mm-hmm. I think that's partially because it does often mean combining going to see family as well as sort of going back to Europe and things like that. So I think for me, I'm looking at the sky running scene where you've got that slightly more shorter, aggressive technical races in the sort of 20K to 40K range. Which I'm enjoying, or which I would like to be able to enjoy, and sort of looking at Italy and different areas like that, when the Dolomites have got a few races, and the Pyrenees and things. So, I mean, like a lot of people say, "Oh, have you done Boston?" And I think, well, to be fair, if I run a marathon, it's just for my time. It's not because I went to Boston to do it. But I think if we're looking in that kind of measure, I'd probably look more to Europe and sort of experience that kind of, you know, culture change and stuff, and that kind of that newness to experience. But at the same time, yeah, I think if Western States could ever be an option, you know, I'd set it as a, if I could get in, I'd set it as a target and I'd work towards it. But the thrill of the travel and things is part of it as well. So yeah, maybe a bit more of a European focus if I can.
European tour, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Scott Jurek is also vegan. I know you are too, as mm-hmm. well. I am as well. So that's something I'm very curious about. So how many years of your 10-year running career have you been vegan?
So as a vegan, it was, I remember eating, so I was a vegetarian for a couple of years, maybe 3 years. And I was vegan since 2012. In fact, I think I was in a restaurant in France about a week before the CCC in 2012, when I ate my last meal with cheese in. And so we're talking about 8 years as a vegan and 3 years as a vegetarian before that, or 2 years maybe.
Okay. And how have you found it? Like, how has your experience been? Like, what led you to veganism, to make that change in your life? And has it been a challenge to, you know, as you evolve as a runner, but also, you know, fuel is so important, especially in these longer races. Well, I mean, it's important in half marathons and marathons too, but yeah, kind of how has that looked for you?
It was 100% ethical, the reason for the change. It was sort of a two-step thing, I guess, going from vegetarian to vegan. And it's entirely my mum's fault. Just, I don't know why she decided to send me this article from The Guardian about, they were just like, it was a 5-piece article about industrial farming. So it was cows, and then it was like, it was beef, it was the wool industry, it was the chicken industry, it was then the eggs, and then all of it kind of finished up with the abattoir, kind of was like the final piece of it. And I just kind of went through these articles pretty much like in a sort of 2-day period, reading through them, and having up until that moment never made a connection to really what was, you know, in the plastic wrapper on the shelves in the grocers, on my plate, and then, you know, obviously the food I'm eating, never even once made that connection to what actually happened for that to get there. And then me thinking myself, oh, I love animals, you know, I had a cat, and you know thinking myself as an animal lover, it's just like, I don't sort of want to point fingers as this, but I just kind of like, that's completely ignorant to think that there's a whole animal conscious being on the other side of that. And so it's like one day to another, it was like, boom, became a vegetarian. And I was just sort of picking up my eggs from a local a local farm, a guy who had a bunch of chickens around the back. And they sort of occasionally eating cheese and things, and thinking, "Oh, cheese isn't that bad." And then kind of after a while, I was kind of realizing that the milk industry isn't sort of perfect, or I just didn't align with my values. And it was then, 2012 when I stopped eating altogether and stopped wearing any leather products, wool products, sort of it goes from there. I do my best. No one is perfect. I'm never going to say I'm perfect with regards to making sure that my purchases or my choices do not impact animals, but I always make sure that, you know, I'm doing my best to make that sort of ethical choice.
Was the transition an easy one for you to make?
Well, but being that it was like, this is not who I am. I'm not a person who eats animals, like, or harms animals. I think it was basically like, there is no choice here. It has to be done. And so there was that phase, I'd say, of the first couple of weeks where constantly having to check ingredients on the backs of packs before buying things, and then coming up with new recipes, basically completely subbing the whole, you know, my usual meals and weekly meals and stuff for something else. But what happens is you get two or three meals under your belt, and then you get two or three more, and then you get a couple and you go, okay, actually, no, I don't like that one, but I get like another one. And as you know, two or three months go by, you start to have your, you know, you end up tend to eat like 10 meals overall. You tend to sort of eat, you know, on Mondays we have this and on Wednesdays we have that, and there's you know, alternatives and ideas for pizza, and there's veggie burgers and stuff. So when you know it's the one challenge was typically going to a restaurant with, you know, like friends, and being like the only non-meat eater at the table, and kind of asking questions to the waiter and saying, oh, do you know if the bun has got egg in? And it's like kind of an embarrassing question to ask. And everyone's like, oh my God, I'm so sorry for this person. I do apologize. And they, you know, the waiter's always like, you know, yeah, yeah, let me check for you and things. And oh, we don't have that, but we can do this for you and things. And everyone's always been really courteous. If you're courteous, like say, I'm so sorry, you know, just, I want to know, and, you know, fine, can you do, even if it's just pasta with tomato sauce, can you just stick that on a plate for me? And that works. It's always been fine. And occasionally people ask questions about it, and oh, don't you find it hard? And like, well, you know, only when I'm like here and the only option in the pub is a green salad and beer and fries. But honestly, give me the fries, the green salad and the beer, and I'm actually quite fine, because I'm not eating out like that every night. It's like once three or four weeks or something, I'll be like that. And I'm at home doing my own cooking and stuff. So what it does do is it helps me cook from scratch, and I guess that is a much healthier option. Probably forced me and my wife at the time to sort of focus on exploring the cooking and things, and it's gone really well. My ex, she was a fantastic cook, and so there was always stuff like new things on the menu. After a while, it just sort of becomes, you know, part of the, you know, way of life.
So what's your go-to now for a vegan meal?
Oh, good question. So I just got a deep fat fryer. And oh, I'm nice. Experimenting with that. My samosa didn't go too well. It fell apart inside the fryer. So I was basically eating frozen fried peas and fried bread out of the little metal dish. Yeah. That's a good question. I mean, I love all sorts of food. I do love curries. I go for like, they just get a, you know, I used to make my own pizza bases, but sometimes with time these days, I just go and buy a pizza base from the shop and slap like a mixture of like, I do kind of like a vegan cheese spinach mix, and it kind of like, and then just chuck veggies and Gusta sausages on top and chuck it in the oven. And I love that. Maybe a bit too much, because it's just easy, and you can you get loads of vegetables chucked on there as well. It's almost a quiche of veggies on there.
Right.
I do a tortilla, so like a, you know, sort of a meat pile, but I use millet and tofu in the thing with a kind of a mix of spices. So that's kind of my, you know, Quebecan Christmas pie. Recipe with roast potatoes and roast kale and things. I've got a bit of a mix of recipes, and I'm always up for trying new things. I think often these days it's just challenge of time. So you get in from a training and it's already 7:30, you jump in the shower, you nibble a couple of things, and it's 8 o'clock before you start cooking. And so sometimes it's almost as 9 o'clock by the time you start eating, and you're kind of like dying because you're hungry and falling asleep and tired and stuff. And so things which are quick tend to be, you know, always the go-to options. And at the weekends you do a bit more, like, you know, spend a bit more time preparing stuff, and then hopefully make a big batch, and so you've got some leftovers for the week which just need to go in the microwave, and that kind of saves you time as you go along in the week. So yeah, preparing meals at the weekend is often a good thing.
Some meal prep, yeah, is something I need to get better at, because yeah, I'm kind of the same way. You want to just grab something after training or after, you know, a long day or whatever, and it just makes things so much easier. So what about the nutrition side of your training and your racing? Like, what does that look like? Is that a challenge, being vegan and having those, you know, those options, quick options you could just put in your pack for enough nutrients?
So that, I mean, that was basically, I think just the general whole like plant-based diet has evolved in the last 10 years. And I basically watched it really go from where it was to where it's going to. And I still think it's evolving. And I think a lot more people are adopting that lifestyle, maybe not becoming 100% plant-based or vegan, however they're going to describe themselves. But a lot more people are going to go that in that direction and reducing their meat intake. And it's awesome seeing people do it more and more and more. Obviously the question back in the day was, oh, but where do you get your protein from? And, oh yeah, I heard someone died because of that. And you know, it's like, what? And obviously the questions were there and I didn't have the answers. And so, I was like, well, I think the logical thing is, you know, maybe do like a course in nutrition. And I wasn't really in a position to be able to go full time and do a degree or something, but I found an online course, which is basically the equivalent of, let's say, the first semester in nutrition for a degree. And it was all the basics and it was quite wide range. And it did get into sport nutrition and things. And all the way through it was like ticking boxes saying that if you lived a vegan lifestyle, it was perfectly feasible to be able to live a healthy lifestyle at, you know, as a regular person or as a heavily training athlete. I did the maths with regards to, let's say, UTMB, where your protein like needs are going up just because of the amount of training you're doing. But just simply the number of calories you need to eat goes up. And so on that proportion, the kind of the two go up together and you meet your needs. And I once did a conference for the Montreal Vegan Festival and kind of did a little plan of that and description of that and laid it all out. And I was on like 5,000 calories a day training for like, you know, 150 Ks a week, kind of that end period build up to the race, and just kind of made the link to how much calories would actually be in the form of protein. Not by necessarily having to chug down protein shakes every morning or something. And so it was, kind of fairly obvious that you could get by like that. I think the key things are, and there are a couple of key things, which are number one is just the vitamin B12, which does need to be sort of supplemented and usually comes in soy milk or almond milk or all these things, nutritional yeast, and tends to be easily addressed with those. But if you're not taking any of those kind of things, then maybe a B12 supplement is required. Just as a endurance athlete, and whether you're eating meat or not, your iron levels are something which do get taxed. And so you kind of need to be conscious of your iron levels. And I think anyone who trains at a very high level wants to maybe get a yearly blood test just to check on those kind of things. Because again, you can easily have the intake required, but just like non-heme iron, which is the vegetable based iron, does have a few factors which affect absorption, like vitamin C helps it, but drinking coffee kind of impacts it negatively and things. Any kind of endurance athlete does want to get those things checked out because they will affect your performance overall. But all that to be said, these are kind of, I'm going to say, outlier, like risk factors. In general, people can have a very healthy lifestyle with a vegan diet and a very diverse, tasty day-to-day menu as well.
Yeah, like I find like the colors on my plate really like picked up for sure when I made the switch, because you're taking a little bit of this, a little bit of that, like all these different vegetables maybe that I haven't tried, like my intake of vegetables went up dramatically just because, what are you going to eat? Like rice, some potatoes, some spinach, some, whatever it is,
yep.
On the night. Like I like Mexican food, so I'm always making like burritos and quesadillas and stuff like that. But on the trail, what do you grab when you're going for like a long outing, or if it's like a UTMB style race, like is it, do you make your own, like, date balls, or
So to be fair, I haven't found, I cannot say yet that I found the perfect combination or the perfect solution, because it sometimes does vary with intensity, with, you know, climatic conditions. Like UTMB was such a hot race. I think it was in the 30s. It was 33, 34 degrees in the valley. So just most of it was like chugging fluids, and, you know, getting the calories into those fluids was probably the best way to get the calories in there. And then eating was, I think, tend to be like a kind of, you can't predict. And so you kind of want to have a bit of diversity within your reach. And so while it was nighttime, I was eating like boiled potatoes with salt and a bit of olive oil on top, and that was going down well, easy to digest. And just by coincidence, coming to like the hot part of the day, I was eating chips just because they were so salty. I was getting that kind of crunchy contrast to the sweet drinks I was consuming as I was running. And so that's kind of like a bit more on a case by case scenario. One thing I'm seeing right now is just that kind of like the ability to cut hunger when it comes to endurance races, ultra races, I think is an extremely good thing to do. So if folks who know me, and I work with Exact Nutrition and the Fruit 2, Fruit 3 bars, which are out there, like an alternative to an energy gel, perfect for like, you know, getting energy into your body fast. But like any energy gel, you want a little bit more sustenance when it comes to many hours on the trails. And so we're working on a few things right now, which are kind of like a bit more of an endurance bar, where you've got a little bit of fat in there, a little bit of protein, so just a little bit more sustenance, which will take away that hunger that builds up in your stomach. Because what I realized over the years is if I get hungry while I'm running, it kind of distracts me from wanting to race. I'm almost to the point of envy to like, just, you know what? I could just stop here and eat some stuff, and the kind of distraction of hunger goes away. You know, I could just go and stop and eat a burger somewhere. and so having a sort of, we're developing sort of nutrition, which is a bit more, you know, obviously easy to eat as you're going, as you're working out, that sort of moderate to high intensity level of exercise. But still something which is easy to eat and just sort of, you know, gives you a bit more, like I'm gonna say filling of the stomach, that satiation sort of feeling. I'm kind of getting my words mixed up there, but to just sort of cut the hunger and allow you to focus a bit more on the racing.
Oh, that's great. And that's something I definitely wanted to talk to you about. So like, how did the Exact Nutrition side of things come out? Like, how did you get involved and make that, like, that's what you do full time for work?
Yep. So I've been with Exact now for just over 3 years. And I got to say, it's like the perfect marriage of my, you know, everything I love about the science behind nutrition and training and things, combined with all my experience of sales and stuff, and just kind of like in the perfect position right now. But it was Quebec Mega Trail on the 25K race, maybe like the first or second edition. Met Lawrence, the co-founder, who was just like, you know, British guy, so recognized the accent. He came up to me, started chatting. We got talking, and eventually he was like going to races either as a sponsor or, you know, to do, you know, share samples and things. And so I, you know, get a lift with him, and we would both talk about business development. And I think maybe a year or two went by, and we just kind of find ourselves. I was like at the point of time where I was like, okay, you know, I'm looking for this kind of challenge with a business that's growing. They were looking for someone that kind of had my skill set. And, you know, it's, I think, good business partners, or, you know, we made sort of good business partners, good friends, and it just kept on growing from there.
Mm. And so what drew you to that brand, that company? Like, I think it's great. It's right here and, like in Montreal, and, their presence everywhere is felt definitely in the community. Mm. It's, you see them around, you see Lawrence around and handing this stuff out and getting the product out there. Cause that's really the key, I guess, when you're starting a brand, right? So
Absolutely. I mean, if we talk on that level, absolutely. If everyone's got their go-to goos and hammers and cliff shots or whatever they're going to be, and they just kind of, you know, I know this works for me, why do I want to change? Then the challenge is, like, you know, getting into someone's mouth and making them willing to give it a quick try. And obviously it's good product, and so, you know, people are, you know, open to making that change and things. But it's exactly as you says, and it's Lawrence and it's the folks at Exact, it's the ambassadors who are constantly present and having a good time, enjoying themselves. And if people are, you know, enjoying themselves and it's being fueled by a certain, you know, nutrition form, then I think that association kind of rubs off on other people. And Lawrence is the kind of guy who rubs off on other people in a positive, energetic way. I think Exact sits like that in the community. Right now we're evolving. A lot of stuff is going to happen in 2021 for us. Those are all sort of just like been fun projects to work on, fun things with great people. And it's not how did I choose that or anything like that. It's literally just, you know, kind of going with the flow, and there was never any kind of decision making to happen. It was just totally natural and very lucky to sort of be in the right place at the right time for that all to kick off.
And that's that's how I'm here in this, doing this podcast, really. It's it's through running, it's a crazy community, you know, and you connect with so many different people, and you never know what you're going to end up doing next. Because, you know, like, I never thought I'd be doing a podcast, you know, 5 years ago, and we're here in our third season. So it's crazy how that kind of works out. If for people that don't know, what is Exact exactly? And like what's your elevator pitch, I guess, for the product? And just to, like, I know it's like a fruit, my understanding, it's like a fruit bar that's a substitute for gels, like you say, but I'm sure there's more behind it in terms of like scientifically and stuff.
So let's sort of do it in two or three parts then. I mean, most people may not really know Exact the company. They may just know the products, which is a Fruit 2, Fruit 3, Pro Crunch, and Electro 2. I think those kind of product ranges came forward first, and 2021 is actually going to kind of be bringing back everything into the name of Exact, and so people will hear the name Exact a lot more next year. It's kind of like Lawrence comes from he loves cooking, he will cook a roast and always makes an effort with cooking some awesome vegan meals when I'm over and stuff for me. He's passionate about cooking good stuff, and I think it was based on his experience of energy gels prior to that, and was like, there's got to be something better, and if we do this with this, and it's basically a fruit based. It's not a paste, it's just a pâte de fruits, and I couldn't even think. It's a fruit bar, and it's basically a combination of apple pulp and maybe orange pulp or strawberry, whichever the flavor is, with a tiny bit of pectin and sugar on it, just to make, basically do exactly the same job as an energy gel will do, but in a sort of a tasty, enjoyable treat format, as opposed to a sort of slightly synthetic, sticky mess, which is often comes out of these sachets. My way of saying things is a tasty alternative is an energy gel. And, Lawrence is basically saying, you know, we believe there had to be something better than energy gels, and this is what we've come up with. When we get to the science of things, at the end of the day, we're talking simple carbohydrates in the form of glucose and fructose, which most brands are basically using. And so no one has really got a secret ingredient which is going to work better, no matter what Morton's going to tell you about this stuff. It comes down to that. It comes down to the body being able to absorb these different things, you know, the stomach lining, the blood, and our need to be able to sort of, you know, get and, you know, at a high level, at a, you know, it's a high intensity in the range of 60 to 90 plus grams of carbohydrates into our body per hour, which is not easy on the stomach. And so if you can find something which does that and works for you, basically, you know, do it and make sure you're fueling yourself when you go. And we're just kind of stoked that we can do something which people enjoy. And, you know, I gotta say, I love these bars. And that's how we start, how, you know, met Lawrence and things. But it's all about making something tasty. People enjoy it. And hopefully they'll enjoy, you know, achieving their goals. And so the hashtag Fuel Your Goals is sort of, you know, naturally evolved from what we do.
That's awesome. Yeah, and you guys are great. Like I said, Lawrence is a... I remember we were doing, we did a run earlier this summer, I think, a small group of us, and bumped into him on the trail. And he, of course, had his bag of goodies and was more than willing to share with us all, because, you know, I think for him too, he doesn't never know who he's going to bump into or see a familiar face. So that's, you know, we hear a lot of what's going on now with the pandemic is a lot of businesses are struggling and stuff. So, like, definitely for us, it's local. So, you know, we want to support local businesses too. And you know, I'm sure it's been a challenge with without races and stuff like that too, because that's a big part of your presence too, right? So I'll go into that. Like, how does a brand, like, how have you found it in the business world with a brand like that? That's like very much, you know, people gear up for races and stuff. When it's been a year with so little racing, has it been difficult on the brand itself to kind of stay afloat during these times? Or maybe stay afloat's not the right word, but like, have you seen struggles, or is it kind of been status quo?
So, there's probably 100 answers to kind of like to answer that, but I mean, obviously back in the beginning, sort of March, a bit early in the year and stuff, you know, it's panic everywhere, a lot of people on uncertainty and stuff. We like reached out all to our retail partners and stuff, just saying, hey, you know, like, if you've, because we had shipped a lot of stuff before the lockdown happened and these stores just shut down. So it's like, hey, if you've got trouble with, you know, paying a bill or something, then just, you know, let us know, and, you know, we can put some, you know, extend some time and stuff. I think the whole, we were lucky in the sense that the bike stores with the, you know, with the workshops opening up and everyone kind of like, we can't do anything, but we can go for a bike ride. That kind of like reopened a kind of some of the doors which seemed to have shut very quickly, and so a lot of people were like getting back out on their bikes, and even bike stores were selling bikes more and things, and so there was kind of like a bit of luck there in sort of sales going back out at the stores, and you know, a lot of people sort of saying, hey, we can't go to you know, Florida for our holidays that we normally do, but let's get a new bike and do you know, spend our weekends going cycling and doing these kind of things. And so I think the recreational side of the sport kind of exploded. It went right up there, and hopefully people will stick with it as the years go by. I'm certain of it. And so without all the racing, I think a recreational side really did pick up, and I've seen a lot of people just going out and setting themselves those little challenges of, you know, a 30K run in Sutton or in Orford or up in Charlevoix or something. And so the virtual races were all there. There's a sort of always a good... The communities never really kind of just stop what they're doing. If everyone just had to stay indoors, and maybe, let's say the pandemic was worse and it was literally like, do not leave your house, it would have been seriously worse. But I think everyone kind of says, like, turned to their, you know, their dusty old bike in the garage and said, hello, old friend, let's go out there. Let's see what happens. And so people kind of, you know, did that and said, hey, you know, speaking to a friend and maybe, you know, reading about sport nutrition online, because they kind of got into cycling a bit more, and they chat with their guy in the shop and stuff. And so the whole market shifted a little bit in that sense. And yeah, we completely, you know, as a business, scrapped our objectives of growth. And it was kind of just, you know, can we just maybe do what we did last year and not far from it, sort of thing. And so we were very happy with how things went. And it was a huge opportunity to maybe kind of, you know, analyze maybe a couple of years of doing things one way and being forced to do it a different way to help us sort of, you know, I say you learn from your mistakes, or you learn from the challenges. And so this year we managed to learn from a whole bunch of things. So hopefully events will come up. Hopefully we'll be back, you know, doing tastings with people in at expos and you know, sharing the love with people in a bit more of a normal fashion next year. But at the same time, we've been able to do a whole bunch of stuff, which has allowed us to sort of connect with the community in a different way and stay positive. Sort of online has done well, but it's none of it's been easy. I don't think anyone's had an easy time from it, but I think we're all gonna, hopefully if we can survive, we will survive and we'll be better for it in the long term.
It sounds like the business evolved, like the runners have with their goals and stuff. It's they're still running, they've just like try something different. Like I know I had tried different things this season, for example, just like, why not? You know, there's no pressure to be ready for a certain date or anything like that. It was very much like you, you know, okay, I want to go do a 5K, so let's go do a 5K. Or I want to try and run a half marathon, so let's see what we got. You know, like, am I maintaining my fitness? And, you know, it was more fitness-based than anything overall, you know what I mean? So that brings us to, like, a new season that we're going into, which is winter. Today was actually quite nice, but do you have any like tips for like winter running? I know, like, coming from a snowboard background, like, you probably know how to stay warm better than most, but what do you kind of think going into the winter season, and how can people get out there more?
So it's definitely a mistake to say, right, winter's coming, so let's just pack away our running gear and forget about it for the for the next couple of months until it finally gets warm again. It's more to do with, it's not so much bad conditions as opposed to having the right equipment for the conditions, because we know Quebec can be a beautiful sort of fresh snow, kind of a little bit of sun, not too cold kind of day, and then literally within 24 hours it's kind of rained and then frozen and dropped to minus 20 and it's just icy and brutal everywhere. And so it's kind of, it is a little bit about having equipment. And so being not in Montreal, where maybe sidewalks get salted and cleared every day, it's about having some footwear. Like a Gore-Tex shoe helps keep your foot dry and warm, as well as having a shoe, whether you've put a slide-on crampon to your shoe, so you've got a bit of metal, which can have a bit more traction with the ice and snow underneath your feet. A lot of brands I'll plug Salomon here with the sponsorship and stuff. They've got shoes with the spikes and that, you know, and a gaiter integrated in things, and it's like a perfect winter shoe. But it's about having that kind of right equipment so you can have a bit of traction and a bit of confidence when running. And then when it comes to clothing, it's funny. I sometimes see someone with like a big puffer jacket out running, and it's kind of like the wrong thing to do. Rather than having one single big warm layer, you want to focus maybe on having two, three like thin layers, kind of like multi-layering when it gets colder, rather than going for one big thick layer. And that way you can sort of unzip things and adjust that heat cold thing, because what you want to avoid is, obviously, if you're going to run for half an hour and stuff, you want to start with a bit warm. But if you're going out for an hour or so, then you're going to find yourself warming up quite quickly if you've got too many layers. And then you start sweating and you've got that kind of balance of, you know, sort of freezing cold in one place and then sweating in the other. And so just sort of multi-layering is always a good thing. And I love a top with a good zip, you know, like a half zip. And so that can like open up and just a little bit of cool and things. For me personally, I get the Reynolds, I'm saying in French, maybe rather than English, but it's basically when your fingers go, your fingers are white and freezing cold. And
oh,
they just
it's a disease. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like a Reynolds disease, I think, or Reynolds sickness. I get that. And I know a couple of good runners which get that. And it's brutally painful. And you can be so hot and so sweaty around the rest of your body, but your fingertips are kind of white and painful and cold. And so what I've learned in years is to have, basically, you can almost like not be too layered on your body. start off and just go, right, the first 10 minutes are kind of cold, but I'll warm up and I'll feel good after like 15 minutes of running. But I'm still wearing these great big mittens to keep my hands warm, and hopefully my fingers don't get too cold and get too painful. And I even get this kind of cream, which actually warms up on the surface of your skin, like a little hand cream. And so 10 minutes before leaving, I'll go and just rub that over my hands, and that kind of warms up the surface of your skin and helps avoid that that Raynaud's sort of setting in. Because that really is that can ruin a run. You're kind of just in agony with your fingertips in pain like that. While the rest of you is too warm, you'd rather just kind of like call it a day, a bit like the hunger thing. you want to call it a day. So yeah, layering. And if you've got the Raynaud's, then those creams and gloves. But as I say, yeah, you're just equipping yourself and remembering you might start off cold for 10 or 15 minutes, but you tend to warm up. And once you're warmed up, you tend to just keep on moving and you can be quite comfortable. And I think one thing I do just, it is sometimes hard to motivate yourself to get out the door. So set yourself a meeting time with a friend. That tends to be a good one. So it's like, hey, I've got to meet that guy at 5:30. And we were planning to go and do a 10K jog or something. Well, if you've got that meeting time, you've kind of got that commitment. So you've kind of got to go and do it. Whereas if it's you by yourself, there's 100 excuses you can create between you and sat on your computer desk and go and get your shoes on and stuff. So that's a good little technique to like force yourself out the door.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. It's like, that's something I did that today. Actually, I set a meeting with a buddy and meet me here, and we take our run from there. But when it gets like into the minus 15, minus 20, or wherever you are, whatever's cold for you, that always seems to be a challenge, is just getting your foot out the door. And then once you're there, it's good. So yeah, accountability is definitely a key one.
Yeah.
And also I wanted to add to that, maybe some reflective gear too, if you have any.
Oh yeah. Sorry, because I'm so probably hitting the trails mostly these days, and so I do forget about that. But reflective gear is definitely a good one to have. When it's snowing, just like visual wise, when you've got snow on the ground, headlamps don't need to be much more than like 200 or 300 lumens, because the white will actually provide a lot of light in reflection. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're right. Being visible to the cars going by, if you're running on the roads, that is good. It's easy to get hold of, like a bib, which is pretty much yellow all over. It weighs nothing. It's just like Velcro straps all around you. But it's better to be seen. You might think you look a bit strange, but it's way better being seen.
Yeah, for sure. And especially when you're in the woods, you got to wear something like a bright orange hat or something like that. So they don't think you're a deer just jumping around.
Yeah.
So in an ideal 2021, what would be your dream race schedule if things could get back to normal?
So I think... it doesn't exist, but it kind of, the same time it does exist, the fact that I turned 40 a couple of weeks ago, and I kind of like, hey, 40, you're at the back end now. And so maybe kind of still getting a PB on those road distances, the 5, the 10, the half marathon and the marathon. I think those would still be a dream. I think the dream to get under 2:30 on the full marathon is achievable if things are okay. Those would be like just sort of proper performance level boxes ticked. And then from there, I think being able to go and enjoy Europe, enjoy some big mountains, have an international race or two to look forward to and enjoy myself in. They'd be great to sort of finish up the summer. And if I'm back in Quebec, let's say sort of September, October time, having a crack at something like Harricana or the Bromont Ultra or something like that at the end of the year.
You've done the Bromont Ultra before?
Yes, I did the 25 in the first year, the 160, I did the 55, and I also did the 80. So I designed the course for all those things, yeah.
Awesome.
Like being the local guy, I was like the guy to do it for Gilles, and had some help from Les Amis des Sentiers, which was the local trail sort of management organization. They gave me the contacts to go and like connect some trails into private terrains and stuff. But yeah, that's like my home turf. That
cool. Yeah, I got to pace for the 100. It was last year. Yeah, for my friend Jeff McGregor, and yeah, it was he hurt himself. Like he got hurt like after the halfway mark, so maybe around 100 or so, and then had to walk a good part of the. Well, from where you could be a pacer. So when I joined him, he was already walking at that point, but we kind of walked the rest of the course together. And it's a challenge, that thing. Like, we weren't running it, but man, it's definitely challenging. And like, I have no urge to do that kind of distance yet anyways. Like, I don't know. I don't know how you guys do it. Like with the mental, like how do you work your mental? I didn't talk to you about that at all. Like, how do you... Is it just your competitiveness that pushes you through these barriers, these markers, or like, is there some mantras that you like to use when you're especially in the longer stuff? You know, like I've ran marathons before too, but when you get up there in distance, what are some things you like to do?
Yeah, so I think there's two sides. There's two things. So, if there's always the common mistake of going out a little bit too fast, and then you're just suffering like in the back end of the race, and it's just horrible and everything hurts and you just want it to be over. And at that point, you've got to sort of suck it up. If you can be a bit more controlled, then it tends to be, and you know, I say that's an experienced and a proper athlete then, or a proper competitor, let's say, or competitive athlete. If you can be controlled and you're sort of, you know, you're pacing yourself and you're concentrating on energy out and energy in with nutrition and stuff and fluids and stuff, then you kind of like focus on that as much as the race, and that kind of gets you through. I don't really have any mantras, but in both cases I kind of just reflect on the awesome meal I'm gonna have after the race. And so there's a restaurant up in Quebec, and so I remember for Quebec Mega Trail, I was not trained for the 110K at all that summer. It was just kind of like, I'll get the points and of doing it, and I should do something. Well, I was a lot more focused on the shorter distances. I think this was 2 years ago. And so I was kind of like dragging my body around that last 25K up Mont Saint-Anne to the summit, and actually now it goes down a little bit and back up a little bit, and I was puking in the woods a bit. It wasn't a good day for me, but it was kind of like just pushing myself through, thinking like, once we're over the finish line and showered, we're going to go and like eat like the biggest like veggie burger and fries and drink beer, and I'm going to have another one, and then I'm going to eat that, and I'm going to eat some like ice cream and all these things. And you kind of just like lay this big spread out in your mind of all the food you're eating and things, and that kind of just like helps you work forward. And so the more you get towards the finish line, like, you know, not dropping out, and the, you know, the harder you push, the more you deserve to like eat that big meal at the end. And so it's kind of like the attitude I go with. It's not a mantra, it's more of a menu.
Yeah, for sure. I'm kind of the same way. I think I ate more before pacing my buddy than he ate. Like I had like I had like a bowl of pasta, like a full baguette. I was like I took a nap, you know. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, but it was it's a fun experience. But and I do like, yeah, like I said, I do like the trails, and yeah, it's quite nice. But again, I don't know if I could ever, I don't know. I've got up to what, 75K or something like that. But it was actually for the COVID Classic that we did this summer.
Oh yeah.
The charity thing that we did, yeah. Where we were doing like 5K laps around our house, which was kind of crazy. But anyways, over the last 10 years, what has running taught you?
Well, the proper preparation is what is going to help you succeed. I think that's probably the one very global sort of lesson that I could say that I've learned. You know, learning from your mistakes, the proper training plan, not being too aggressive, not trying to catch up on training, just sort of, you know, preparing is the key. And that's training as much as it's come to race day nutrition and you know, your crew and what they're going to do for you when you're at the aid stations with them and things. Because sometimes you haven't even got the envy to talk with them. But if they know what to do, you know, they're taking their bottles out of your hydration pack, and they're refilling them, and they're sticking the gels in the right pockets and things. And you kind of just sort of space out while they do that, and you know, eat a chip while they're doing it, and drink a Red Bull while they're doing it, and you kind of like, you know, you sense what they're doing, and you get things through. But that's because from preparation. So I think preparation, that applies to pretty much everything in life. If you want to succeed and you're working towards something, then that's the key. But I think the other thing, and it's sort of always been my thing, is having fun while you're doing it. You can't take it too seriously, because you'll probably end up most of the time just being either frustrated with yourself, disappointed, and you know, not enjoying the things that should just really be enjoyed, because there's success to be had in having the fun, and so, you know, combine the hard work with having fun, I think it tends to work out all right. And you can't make yourself want to fall in love with running, and especially after 10 years, it's got to be, you're going to go with those feelings, and so having fun with it is obviously a critical part of it.
And a good training partner too. I know your dog likes to go with you on these runs too, right?
Yeah, well, he loves to get out. He's a good trail buddy. I think sometimes after a few Ks, he's like, hey, you know what? I could go in if you want to go in. And sometimes it's like that. But he's just looking for his bowl of food mostly. Yeah. I do enjoy it when we're just sort of, you know, I do enjoy the most is an extremely like easy level run, which is just off in the woods somewhere, kind of out there, and you know, you can feel the sun on your skin, and you're not feeling like you've got to train hard. But at the same time, I'm deeply passionate about like chasing my friends around the track and doing interval training and sort of really pushing my body's limits. Again, it's that sort of diversity which makes, you know, diversity of the races I work towards, which makes it all fun.
Where's your favorite place to run? Like maybe in Quebec and around the world. Like where's the place you've ran that you really loved the most?
Well, I mean, obviously, if you going back to UTMB location of Chamonix, where you've got like Mont Blanc right there, and you kind of always, it's always kind of visible, and the big mountains and the fantastic views of the French Alps, and then that kind of the little villages in between each of the valleys and things, that is amazing. Transvolcania, which was I'm forgetting now the name of the island, but that was, I mean, as scenery goes, that was the most spectacular. It went from like molten lava, like beaches, up until this kind of like tropical forests, up to almost like alpine summits, and then back down into like a Spanish coastal village, like down in the other side of the island. Like that was the most spectacular one. But then running in Scotland and things was a real thrill. But to be honest, I mean, those are all beautiful places which I'd all love to go back to and you know, run again. I do enjoy just that sort of, I guess, say that kind of remoteness and technical terrain that you get in Sutton, around the back of the mountain. I always loved the old X Trail route where you'd run past the two lakes, Mohawk and I'm having a blank about the other one, but the two lakes there, because when it was hot, you just like dive into the lake, you know, jump out, eat a gel, and then just keep on cruising. And, you know, you head down to the village, you eat a bowl of fries and a drink of beer. And I think that's always been a, you know, a perfect day for me and in sort of, you know, what I consider, you know, perfect trail running conditions. So, you know, not far from home, and lucky to have that.
For sure. For sure. Hopefully we can get out for one maybe next year or something, and a nice trail run out there in the mountains. You probably know them better than I do. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, Bromont now has the Parc de Somme, which is like some of the trails around the back have opened up into a municipal park. This year I've seen a ton of runners like checking out trails, exploring it. So and that's my backyard of training and things. But you know, come check that out, hit Sutton, and just, you know, I'm always happy to show people the sweet spots of
for sure.
Running.
What does running mean to you?
I think it's just, I don't know. I don't know if like the way things came together in my life, I guess it was just sort of a lucky crossing of a whole bunch of things, which have made, allowed me to find a whole combination of passions together. Again, going into the connection to nature, with exploring the limits of my body in an athletic manner, to having fun with friends, to connection with nature, to being able to travel, you know, which a large part of that was the same with the snowboarding, maybe not with the whole testing the limits of the body, but still, you know, testing the limits of, you know, doing something scary even in snowboarding. So it's just that kind of like whole cross-section of things happening. It's just allowed me to find that combination of them, which is sort of that sweet spot of all of them happening together. So I don't know if that's a meaning for me, but that's kind of just where I am with it.
Yeah, it sounds like a nice, you know, it's a nice balance in your life of a lot of things that, and there's a certain synergy to it that's kind of come together. So that's awesome. Where can people find out more about you and about like what you do and maybe about Exact and stuff like that?
Instagram is ALI, so it's Ali5150, ALI5150. I kind of have periods where I'm like active on it quite a lot, and then other periods sometimes just, you know, work gets in the way and there's like a whole 2 or 3 weeks which I kind of hardly touch it, and then there's like a whole month where I'm like hammering out stories and stuff. I think greatveganathletes.com, or I think it's that, they have my page up and a couple of my stories from things that I do. The guys at Distance Plus, the Quebec trail running or endurance magazine, have got a couple of articles on me. You know what, I don't know if I've got like an athlete page on our own exactnutrition.com website. I think it's more just the owner bio, the co-owner bio. So maybe I should get that fixed up. But Facebook and the usual things are those locations to learn about me. And often people hit me up with questions via Messenger, and I'm always happy to answer them. I think usually the questions come in about trail running and the vegan diet and stuff. And those are one of the few things that I really enjoy, kind of answering, because I think there's a lot of myths out there, and they're easily dispelled. And I'm lucky to have the kind of the experience and the education to be able to do that.
That's great, yeah. And we'll get those links from you, and we'll throw them in the show notes so people can find what you're talking about. So that's always good. Thank you so much, Alistair, for taking the time with us today. And like I said, it was a long time coming, but I'm happy I got your take on the trails and the road. And I look forward to seeing you out there on the race course again sometime next year.
I know. I'm really, really keen to sort of get back into that, you know, sort of like, you know, at least being able to get people grouping together without having to worry about, you know, masks and the social distancing and events like Take the Bridge and all the races out there and stuff. It's a chance to catch up with people. And, you know, being able to, for you, Justin, be able to put out the podcast and things and allow us to sort of share our stories is an awesome thing as well. But yeah, I'm looking forward to sort of, you know, getting out and having fun with friends again.
Yeah, I appreciate that, man. We'll definitely see you soon. Take care.
Hey, thank you, Justin.
Bye. Are you already subscribed to Le Rundown, Running with WRG, and still can't get enough? Sign up to our weekly newsletter and always stay connected. You can learn more about what's happening in the run community, hear about exclusive events, and stay up to date with the podcast. Visit iamarunner.ca and subscribe. Simple as that. You'll never miss a beat. Thank you for joining us on this episode of Le Rundown. We hope you enjoyed our show. Please make sure to visit us at iamarunner.ca. You can also let us know what you think and follow us on Instagram at Le Rundown. Now take what you've learned and run with it.
The Rundown is a production by WRG Media, recorded in the historic RCA building in St. Henry, Montreal. Produced and recorded by Forrest McKay. Our executive producers, Leslie and Lindsay Woods. Graphics and illustrations created by Ryan Bondi and hosted by Justin Pugliese.